It'll be fine.
Blog Talk Radio.
If in life's magic you believe, and in yourself and in your dreams, believe in fairy ball and fairy queen. When you my darling girl.
Welcome, listeners, at this unusual lunchtime hour for the show. Let me take the opportunity to say carpe diem, seize the day, because usually we're on in the evening. And it is with joy that I am celebrating the returning of the light and the shedding of the old so that the new and the wondrous new possibilities might fill those places left vacant. May we all receive prosperity and abundance from nooks and crannies we might not even have imagined. So shall it be. So if you're sneaking a listen on your lunch break or you're in the car running errands or whatever you might be doing right now, I thank you for spending the next hour or so with me. I'm your host, Karen Tate, of the long-running Voices of the Sacred Feminine radio show, and I thank you for tuning in to our Four Mothers and Wayshower series that is still going on. I'm grateful for you tuning in and making the show so popular, so please keep tuning in, sending your emails and articles, and don't forget to keep listening to us and mark us as a favorite at Blog Talk or become our friend. You do all that on the Blog Talk site of my show page for Voices of the Sacred Feminine. And a special shout out to Marietta in Boston, who I heard from this morning, who likes the show. Thank you, Marietta, for writing and for telling me about yourself. Let's make sure we stay connected. And I also have to give a shout out to the wonderful artists who are so generously allowing me to use their music. What you were hearing a bit of was Jenna Green, and that selection from her CD is called Believe. I use a lot of Jenna Green's music because it is so lovely, and you can actually Google her and hear a lot more of her music at her Green Lady Music site. And as a reminder, before we get to today's guest, the foremother Carol Crist, I want to let you know we've moved the sometimes controversial but always informative What's the Buzz segment to the bottom of the show. That way our guest doesn't have to wait through it on the line and we get to them right away. That's the segment when I tell you about the bees that have been buzzing around in my bonnet all week, where we show how the sacred feminine or her ideals are relevant in today's world. And it's where I'm an equal opportunity whistleblower when women's rights are being trampled or oppressed, or anyone's for that matter. The goddess is about lots of things, including equality, justice, harmony, balance, and tolerance. So when those values aren't being adhered to, well, I'm going to mention it. And I sprinkle in good news, too, wherever I can find it. So stay tuned through the end of the show. This week we'll be covering some of the following topics. We're going to follow up on comments from last week about Pat Robertson saying Haiti was suffering because they made a pact with the devil. Well, we have a letter from Satan to Pat Robertson about Haiti. You may have already seen it, but if not, I think we'll have a little bit of fun with that. Also, on more... I guess more serious topics, why women's reproductive freedom ensures our survival. We're going to hear from Dr. Vandana Shiva about a feminist response to the Copenhagen Climate Change Conference. She's a world-renowned ecofeminist, and she talks about how the U.S. is totally captive in the hands of big business, which led to a failure at the conference. And an interesting article I came across that was food for thought. Are Americans too broken for the truth to set us free? It asks if we've become too passive as a people, if our morale can be restored so that we really can set ourselves free and change the course of things. And I just want to ask listeners, I'm putting this out to you, and I hope you'll call in and give me your comments. Are you concerned about the anti-intellectualism movement, the dumbing down of America? If you have any comments about that, I'd love to hear from you, because that's sure a constant bee in my bonnet these days. Call toward the end of the hour, and we can discuss that. And if you've sent in any of those articles for me to share, you know who you are. Thank you. So you'll want to be sure to stay tuned in while those bees vent their leaf later in the show. And just like you can call in and talk to our guest, you can call in later and talk to me about whatever's on your mind. The call-in number for Carol and myself is 718-766-4662. Oh, and before I forget, you can always email in questions in advance of the show if you can't listen live or maybe don't want to call in. We have listeners that do that quite frequently. So please consider calling in and speaking to either Carol or myself. But now let me turn my attention to our foremother who's patiently waiting there. She's talking to us from Greece. That's why the difference in the time change of the show today. And just in case you're new to Goddess Spirituality, let me share a bit of her bio. And remember, if you'd like to chat with us later in the show and take advantage of this opportunity, the number is 718-766-4662. Well, Carol's website is goddessariadne.org, and you can find out more about her there. She leads Carol Crisp. She's a PhD, a pioneer, and founding mother of the goddess, women's spirituality, and feminist theology movements, and she directs the Ariadne Institute. She's been teaching in feminist educational settings in Greece since 1981. The Ariadne Institute programs address the mind, body, and spirit, encouraging embodied thinking and personal transformation. Several hundred women of all ages, including artists, writers, educators, students, homemakers, businesswomen, they've all participated in her program since 93. And let's see, she says, we're joined in the Ariadne Sisterhood and keep in touch through our newsletter, Ariadne's Thread. But more about some of her other accomplishments. She holds a PhD from Yale University, and she's the author of the widely reprinted essay, Why Women Need the Goddess, which was introduced, which has introduced many to the rebirth of the ancient religion of the goddess. She's written five influential books on women's spirituality and feminist theology. They're called She Who Changes, Rebirth of the Goddess, Odyssey with the Goddess, Laughter of Aphrodite, Diving Deep and Surfacing, and she co-edited the classic anthologies Weaving the Visions and Women's Spirit Rising, which have changed women's lives and revolutionized the teaching and study of religion in North America. So, Carol, thank you so very much for sticking with us here and being on the show.
It's wonderful to be talking with you again, Karen, and I certainly appreciate all the work you've been doing as well, for the women's spirituality and goddess movements.
Well, thank you. Thank you. It's been a pleasure to be able to talk to people such as yourself and bring you to our listeners because so many of them feel so much better connected that, you know, they can actually, you know, hear your voice and know that you're still out there and you're still passionately doing the work. And I think it just, you know, it just all keeps a more meaningful, you know, connection among, you know, women around the world because, after all, it is us that who are going to have to change things.
Yes.
I have to ask you, I know it's a silly question, but so what time is it in Greece?
It's just a little bit after 9 p.m., and it's here in Lesbos. We've had cold weather lately, although we've had unseasonably warm winter.
Oh, okay. Well, I was hoping it wasn't the middle of the night for you. I know we tried to make it as convenient as possible. Well, listen, I know you wanted to talk a bit about Haiti, so let's start there. And what were your thoughts you wanted to share with listeners?
Well, I just had an email from someone who I'm in touch with through Facebook, and she asked me what I thought about some of the New Age thinkers that she'd, websites that she'd been looking at, where they were saying that in some way what happened in Haiti was either a lesson that the Haitians needed to learn or it had to do with their karma. Actually, ideas that were being expressed in New Age and even goddess websites that weren't that different from, as you said, Pat Robertson saying it was, you know, it was God's will. Mm. And I just wanted to say, and even the president said he found this very cruel and incomprehensible. And somehow behind that, I think, was lurking the question, did God cause this through God's cruelty? And I just wanted to say that any type of deity that I would ever believe in does not test humanity in cruel and sadistic ways and did not cause this earthquake. This earthquake was caused, as scientists know, by the plate movements in the Earth. This is one of the ways our planet shows that it's alive and it renews itself. It is kind of, in a way, telling us that all life on the planet doesn't revolve around human beings, but it has nothing to do with Haitians in particular. It's just something that was predicted to happen and would have happened. If anyone was cruel, it isn't the deity, who I believe is always with us in our suffering and in our joy, and does not have all the power in the universe, because other beings like the plates and ourselves and animals and plants have our own degree of will or freedom that works together to create the world as we know it. So God doesn't do everything, and Goddess doesn't do everything. And I believe that the deity is the goddess, or if you prefer to call it God, is always with us, always trying to inspire us and show us the most creative way to respond. And if anybody's responsible for this, it's the nations and the people who haven't responded to the suffering of Haiti in the past.
Well, you know, Carol, I'm so glad you're saying that, because, I mean, these poor Haitians have been a repressed people for hundreds of years. You know, why would they bring retribution on themselves? I mean, you know, that's just crazy. I mean, I don't know, just to my thinking, there are other people out there exploiting people, greed, excess. You know, just my personal opinion, and I agree with you that, you know, God or Goddess isn't, you know, going to interfere. But, you know, those would be the things that I think, you know, if anybody was going to intercede, those would be the things to be punished for, not what these poor suffering people have been going through for hundreds of years. It just doesn't make any sense.
No, it doesn't make any sense. And I think part of what this conversation, to the extent that it's still going on within the Goddess movement and within the New Age movement, shows is how hard it is for old ideas to die. We think that we're in a very revolutionary new age, new way of thinking, and yet we're still trotting out these old ideas that God has all the power and God is the type of a deity who punishes or tries to teach us lessons like a
well,
a,
and remember,
mean
this all
parent.
this all came up during Hurricane Katrina too, you know. I mean,
yes.
Pat Robertson brought up this idea. And, you know, my observation is, you know, this is more about racism and homophobia, because Pat Robertson doesn't come out and say, you know, when rivers, you know, overflow their banks and people are being flooded in the Midwest and red states, that, you know, God is punishing them. You know, he picks on, you know, black people, unfortunately. He picks on gay people. And, I mean, at least that's what he's done in Katrina, and now he's done again in Haiti. And I think it speaks more to the isms, you know, and the phobias as well. I don't know. It's just my personal opinion, but that's, you know.
I completely agree with that. And I also think that for far too long, people have modeled their concept of God on what my favorite philosopher Charles Hartshorne calls the tyrant ideal of God. That is, God is the one who has power over, who can do whatever he wants, and who has all the power in the universe. So whatever happens, it has to be God's will, because God is the one who's in charge and responsible for everything. And I think it's much more, and these ideas come through in the New Age and even among people in the Goddess movement from time to time, because they're so well rooted in our psyches and have been part of the way we've been thinking in the West and to a large extent in the East as well for thousands of years. And I think that part of what the feminist revolution in spirituality is about is learning to understand the divine power, the Goddess, as a power that is with us, that is omnipresent but not omnipowerful, and who works with us in a co-creative way, inspiring us, moving us to transform the world, but not doing it with a mighty arm.
Well, and to go back to your comment that, you know, God is not this sadistic God, I mean, I have in one of my YouTube videos, you know, going back to, you know, God would not put one gender above the other either. You know, that's a whole, you know, that's another whole issue that plays into this programming, you know, you're talking about, that these ideas that are so entrenched. I mean, how cruel would that be to set one gender above another? I mean, that's total man-made dogma. And, you know, I often say to people, you know how I envision God and Goddess? I see them sitting in their rocking chairs in heaven, rocking back and forth, holding hands, scratching their heads, saying, you know what? What happened to our children? Why did they divorce us and kick you to the curb, Mother? You know, I mean, that's the vision I hold, you know, and they're just wondering when we're going to come to our senses and restore balance to this world.
Yes.
Well, I know you also wanted to talk about Mary Daly, you know, a foremother I wish I could have gotten here on the show. She passed the beginning of the month, and we mentioned her passing last week, but had you ever had the opportunity to meet Mary Daly, Karen?
Yes. Yes, I met Mary Daly actually before she transformed into the totally radical figure that she became. I met her shortly after she had written The Church and the Second Sex and before she wrote Beyond God the Father, and I've known her through the years, not well, but I had seen her from time to time and spoken to her recently the last few years on the telephone. I think that she was really a radical figure and someone who had the courage to say that Christianity and biblical religions and all other patriarchal religions really are based in patriarchy. That is sort of their essential nature, and it would be very hard, she would say impossible, for them to be reformed. And I think she got into a lot of trouble for saying that, for leaving the church. She famously led an exodus, as she called it, from one of the churches at Harvard and with other women. And I think she inspired a lot of us, including myself, to look really seriously at Christianity as a religion that not only sort of has the suppression of women as a side issue or a small issue, but that it's really woven into the very fabric of the religion. And she, I think she'll always be remembered for her bravery. And I certainly felt very touched when I heard that she had died.
Well, Carol, when I was reading some of her history, it talked about how she didn't want to teach men. Why was that? Why did she not want men in her class?
She let men into some of her classes, but she didn't like them in her advanced feminism classes. And the reason is sort of the same reason why I lead goddess pilgrimages to Crete for women only. And this is something that a lot of women discovered in the 70s and late 60s and in through the 80s, that when women gathered together and were not in the presence of men, a lot of women tend to be more open with each other and be able to express their deepest feelings, some of their fears, some of their shame, talk about violence that has occurred to them at the hands of men, talk about their sexuality, their feelings about their body. And many times when men are in the room, either they take over, they want to tell you how things should be, they get threatened by some of the things that women say, or just their very presence causes women to censor themselves. Hmm. And I know when I taught women's studies, I didn't exclude men from my classes, but I understand why Mary Daly did, because many times I had men in the class who were quite sensitive and quiet and listened and wanted to learn from women, and actually have learned a lot in my classes, and some of them got on to become important male feminists in their own right. But there have been other cases where the men really do try to take over, and then it becomes more of a hostile situation. So that was why she wanted women to be really free to think our most wild thoughts, to speak the most unspeakable truths. Mm-hmm. And the way it was presented in the papers was really unfair because she was willing to tutor men who wanted to study anything she had to teach. She would tutor them privately.
Okay.
But anyway, that's probably enough on Mary Daly. I know we have other things we want to talk about.
Well, just one last quick question. If you were to recommend any of her books, which is there one you might recommend above the others?
Yes, I would recommend Beyond God the Father, which is the one where she lays out the reasons why she left Christianity and why she believes that patriarchy is a worldwide religion based in an unholy trinity of what she called rape, genocide, and war. And she didn't think that was only Christianity that stood for that, but really she sees that as a worldwide religion. The other book I would recommend is Gynecology. And I have to confess that after that, I didn't really follow Mary Daly where she was going. I had a hard time with reading a lot of her later works.
Okay.
Personally.
Well, I'm teaching a Cakes for the Queen of Heaven curriculum at the Goddess Temple down in Orange County, and I want to make sure we add her, these two books, to the recommended resources.
Yes, that's a good idea.
So, Carol, you are there. Well, you're there on Lesbos, but you teach and lead women tours in Crete. Why Crete? Why did you choose that island?
Well, I think a lot of people are familiar with the Greek goddesses like Athena and Aphrodite and Demeter. But if you start studying their mythologies and you start studying more about ancient Greek religion, I think you'll find that despite the fact that they had goddesses, Greek religion was actually quite a patriarchal affair. The father god Zeus was a rapist. He went around raping not only human women, but nymphs and, semi-divine and even divine figures. And this was considered just sort of okay. And a lot of the goddesses are portrayed in negative lights in some of the myths, such as Aphrodite couldn't fight in the Trojan War. She limped off the battlefield injured and so on. And in my own search for the goddess, I really wanted to find out if there was a time and a place when patriarchy was not the lens through which the whole of the world was portrayed and understood. And so I was searching behind and beneath the biblical stories, behind and beneath the Greek myths. And one of the places that seems to be plausible. I mean, I won't say it's definitively proved because nothing can be definitively proved about a long, long time in the past, but I believe that Crete, unlike classical Greece, was a society that was not based on domination. It was based on power with rather than power over. There's no sign of king's thrones or large palaces or big graves of big men. No sign of weapons and warfare, no sign of standing armies or kingship. And it is a society that I believe worshipped the feminine divine and was very much understood that to be Mother Earth and to be the powers of birth, death, and renewal. But it's also a society where I believe there's no sign that women were not equal. And there's also no sign that women oppress men. I mean, that's always the next question people ask. And I think that there were societies where women and the female principle and the principle of motherhood and creativity and regeneration were honored as female, but men were not dishonored. They were also understood to participate in that same creative process.
So we're talking
and
about more of an egalitarian
society. I can't hear you.
We're talking about more of an egalitarian society.
Yes, an egalitarian society, not a patriarchal dominator society.
Now, in feminist scholars also believe the same thing about Çatalhöyük potentially in Turkey. Is that correct?
Yes, and I think that Maria Gimbutas is a very important archaeologist and theorist who's talked about what she calls old Europe, and that is a Europe that existed before the Greeks. I mean, basically we've been taught that history began, you know, with the Greeks and with classical Athens. Democracy was born there. The concept of the individual was born there. Of course, they usually just gloss over the fact that women were not allowed to vote in classical Athens. They weren't part of the democracy. They weren't part of the individual who was being celebrated. And so going back before that classical Greece, let's say roughly around 400 BC, ancient Crete, Minoan Crete, roughly 3000 BC to 1450 BC, so more than 1,000 years before classical Greece, and is part of what Marie Gimbutas calls Old Europe, which was a society based in agriculture. People were sedentary, settled down, not moving around a great deal, although there was trade, and there were people who were trading, but the majority of the people were settled in one place, very close to the land, living in tune with the rhythms of birth, death, and renewal, and worshiping the earth as the goddess.
So what you're saying is that this idea of this, you know, a more egalitarian society and sync with the land without the patriarchal overtones was probably, you know, beyond Minoan Crete, probably beyond Chatel Hayuk. It was actually in old Europe as well.
Yes, I would say that probably these types of societies existed all over the world, although I'm not really as familiar with the history of non-European cultures as I am with European, but I think there are plenty of hints that, for example, what's called the Indus Valley civilization that preceded the Sanskrit-based Brahmin culture of India was probably quite similar. And one of the things that is said about these cultures is they're to do with the earliest farming, which is called the New Stone Age or the Neolithic. And it's thought that women were probably the inventors of agriculture because women were the ones who were gathering the seeds and the fruits and the berries and the nuts and bringing them back to the campsite and preparing food. And they would have been the ones who would have maybe dropped some of these seeds or nuts and the next year come back and saw that something grew. So it makes sense that women being more involved in plant gathering, men being more involved in hunting, women would be the ones who invented agriculture. And I think that in the beginning of agriculture, it was not just a technical process, but it was understood to be connected to the great powers of the life force, the powers of birth, death, and renewal, which also can be seen in the female body, which gives birth and menstruates. And so that the female body became a symbol for the great powers of birth, death, and renewal that were also part of agriculture, of planting and nurturing and then harvesting or death.
Well, now let me ask you. I know we've talked about Crete, but let's think about. Let me ask you about pre-Olympian Greece in general, like, you know, on the mainland. I sort of usually describe it as, you know, if you look at classical Greek goddesses, they're a shadow of their former selves. You know, Hera's turned into this petulant wife, you know, chasing after her philandering husband as if she would, you know, diminish herself. So, Aphrodite is just this boudoir babe, you know. They've been denigrated. Is using the term pre-Olympian accurate? If we go back before classical Greece, do you call that pre-Olympian? Where do we go to learn the more authentic essence of these goddesses? What can we turn to turn away from that, you know, that Christian lens and that classical Greek lens?
Yes, well, pre-Olympian certainly is an appropriate term because Zeus, the father god, the father of the gods and the father god, dwelt on Mount Olympus. But Maria Gimbutas also coined, I think, a broader term, which is Old Europe. And Old Europe preceded, you know, the classical Greece and, you know, the Europe that we know.
Okay.
which we could now call the New Europe. That's the one we're still living in.
It's not just a place, but it's also sort of a time period, I guess.
Yeah, and it's old Europe also coincides with the beginning of agriculture prior to the introduction of warfare. And generally speaking, the cultures of old Europe were without the horse, and the horse came in with the warriors as part of, as Maria Gimbutas says, an invasion that probably started somewhere out of Siberia, the area of the Black Sea.
Let me ask you about Athena, please, because I know Athena always raises questions in women's minds. It almost seems like Athena is sort of a traitor to, I'm just going to use the term very loosely, the matriarchy, she's more of a defender of the patriarchy. It's the way they paint her picture. Her mother doesn't have a role in her birth. You know, she's all for the warriors, you know, that whole thing. But I know if you look deeper at Athena, she actually has roots from the Mycenae area. Can you sort of paint a more authentic picture of who Athena was pre-Olympian or pre-classical Greece?
One of the things she's associated with is the olive tree, the cultivation of the olive tree. And another thing she's associated with is spinning and weaving. And as I was saying before, I think one of the actual scientific, intellectual contributions of women to culture was the invention of agriculture. So the cultivation of the olive tree, of course, in the Mediterranean world, provided one of the basic staples of life. I mean, even today, a Cretan family will eat, let's say, consume 150 liters of olive oil per person per year. This is a huge amount. And mostly picked from their own olive trees, which have come down to them and their families over hundreds and hundreds of years. And also she was associated with spinning and weaving, and that was another invention of women during the Neolithic period, and I think it also was viewed as a mystery of transformation. In Crete, we have the legend or myth of the Minotaur, which was a half-man, half-beast, half-bull, born from the lust of his mother for a bull and hidden away in a dark place and then demanding human sacrifice of Athenian girls and boys. And this is a story the Greeks told, and it really is such a reversal of what I imagine the original story was, because as we travel in Crete and as you study about ancient Crete, you learn that much of the worship in ancient Crete took place on mountaintops and also in the deepest recesses of caves. And I think having done it many times myself, gone into four levels into a very dark cave called Skotino, which means dark, where the Minoans had worship and rituals and probably initiation rites, it's like entering into the womb of your mother again to be reborn. And what the Greeks did was take this idea that the Minoans went into the darkness of the womb of the mother earth, the mother mountain, in order to be reborn, to put a monster down there who's demanding human sacrifice. It's such a reversal of what the Minoans, I believe, really did believe. Then they take Ariadne, which is known to us as the Minoan princess, and she gives Theseus the thread. He goes down, kills the monster in the darkness, spirits her off, dumps her off on an island, goes back to Athens and becomes a hero. And again, Ariadne is actually a name that is thought to be pre-Greek, probably one of the names of the Minoan goddesses. And she's turned into a woman who betrays her culture, betrays her brother, who is this Minotaur, and then she gets left, and then a woman, dumped on an island. And it's very much like what happened in the writing of the Genesis story.
The woman is the bad one.
Where you have the sacred tree, the sacred body of the woman and the holy snake, and you turn all of those into something evil and nasty.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know what that also reminds me of, too, is the story of Medusa. Here you, and now tell me if I have this wrong, because Greek myth is not my forte, but you have Medusa, who started out as a priestess in Athena's temple. She's lusted after by, I think, Poseidon, who rapes her. And then she's the one that gets punished and turned into Medusa with the snakes on her head. On the island, and she turns into the bad person that turns everybody into stone. So it's like you victimize, you know, you punish the victim. And that never sat right with me either. How would, you know, how could Athena have stood for that unless, again, we're talking about the patriarchal Athena?
Yes, and if you visit the National Museum in Athens, you will see the hero Perseus holding the severed head of Medusa in every room of the museum over and over again. It was an icon, an image that was portrayed and portrayed again. And I believe that it's, you know, on a deeper level, it's the slaying or the overthrow of the ancient culture of the mother goddess. And the hero then kills his mother, if you want to say it that way.
Mm-hmm.
And he moves on without her, holding
her severed head.
It's Tiamat.
You know,
yes, it's Apollo slayed the sacred snake of Gaia. Marduk slayed Tiamat, the sea mother. Yes, I believe that it's really one of the origins of the tragedy of our culture is the slaying of the mother, because if you really think about it, you know. Where do we get life? We get it from our mothers. Now, I know everyone didn't have the nicest, most perfect, nurturing mother, but if you are in a culture that honors the mothers, then you're obviously more likely to have a more nurturing mother, not one who's been twisted and turned by the brutality of patriarchy and self being demeaned and so on. But if we don't honor life, then what are we about? And if we don't honor the one who gave us life, which is our mother, and then going back farther than that, the ancestors, the mothers and the mother's mothers, and fathers and grandmothers, many, many traditional cultures honor those who have come before us and who have given us life, and in particular, the mother. But our culture, through this myth of the slaying of the mother, which we carry on in various ways in our daily lives today, whether it's beating or raping or beheading women. I mean, that
right.
still happens, unfortunately, today,
yeah.
too. So I believe that actually the slaying of the mother is at the root of our culture and at the root of the tragedy that lies at the heart of what we, if we want to call it, the new Europe, modern world.
Have you had a chance there in Greece? Are they playing the movie Avatar yet?
No, I haven't seen that. But one thing I wanted to share with you relating to this concept of honoring the mother is that in Crete, when we're traveling around, even today, people have a spirit of great generosity. They're always giving you something. Like if you're walking down the street in a village, and somebody's just picked some fruit, they'll offer you fruit. If they see you, they're drinking coffee, they'll offer you coffee. If they meet you in a group, they'll bring out, you know, little glasses and fill them with raki, which is a liqueur. And they're always giving. And for us as Americans, it's actually kind of odd and sometimes
mm-hmm.
even embarrassing, because
mm-hmm.
mostly these people are less wealthy than we are,
mm-hmm.
and yet they're giving to us, and they don't even know us.
Right,
and
right.
The more
and
I thought about this, I've thought a lot about this because it's happened so many times. I think it's actually the basic understanding of old Europe or of the pre-patriarchal culture, which is that life has been given to us, and much abundance has been given to us, and our job is to give it back.
Reciprocity, yes.
And when we talk about giving and receiving in a Christian context, know, we always say, well, you give, but you don't have any, you don't need to receive anything back. And actually, and you almost, you know, if you're really Protestant or something, or, you know, you don't expect God to give you anything back or anybody to give you anything back, you just give to show you're a good person. But it's not like that for them. I think of, even in my voice, I became sort of tense as I was talking about, you know, not expecting anything back. I'm just giving to show I'm a good person. They're not doing it for that. They're doing it because they understand that that's the way life is, that we've been given and we give to others and we'll be given again. And It's as important to receive as to give.
Well,
it's important to give back because we have been given. And in I believe in the ancient Minoan rituals, the most important rituals revolved around, again, the agricultural seasons. So the first fruits, the first cherries, the first apricots, the first walnuts would be in a procession brought to a sacred place, laid on an altar. The mother would be thanked for giving her bounty to us. Some would be given back to her in the form of things just left on the altar or libations of liquids like oil or wine being poured on the altar, but then it would be shared in the community so people would understand that we're in this together and we've been given together, and that's why we give to each other.
And we've lost the sense of that, especially, you know, here we have the message in the United States. I know especially, you hear the GOP is always about individuality, you know, pull yourself up from your bootstraps. I mean, not to say that people shouldn't work hard and strive to do better, but there's no sense of interconnectedness.
No.
that we need to help each other, that, you know, let's make sure all of our boats float. You know, that's just sort of been lost. And, you know, it amazes me here in the United States. I mean, some people who aren't very well off themselves suddenly, you know, buy into this rhetoric. And it's like, you know, where's your brain? You know, you're supporting something that's against your own interests.
Yes, and all the conversation that, I mean, I've watched a lot of it on CNN and other programs that I can get here in Greece about the U.S. health program that Obama's trying to pass. I mean, the conversation is just been so much. Well, I don't want to give what I have to him or to her or to someone who doesn't work. You know, a welfare mother or someone who doesn't have a job. And people, I mean, I just keep saying to myself, aren't we in this together? And, you know, couldn't it happen to me too? Couldn't I lose my job and not have health care? I mean, as a matter of fact, I myself have had a mild form of cancer, and I probably wouldn't be able to be covered to buy individual insurance in the United States, even though, you know, I'm completely well and I'll probably never get cancer again. People, you know, why are you saying it's somebody else that's going to take it from you instead of saying we're in this together?
Yeah.
And we should share.
Well, you know, I think we just have so much. I mean, and that's one of the things we were going to talk about in What's the Buzz. You know, this dumbing down, this anti-intellectualism, I think plays into it too. Too many millions of people are constantly being bombarded by the programming that comes out of Fox News. And it's ugly. It's divisive. We don't have the opposite. You know, we aren't hearing the opposite like what you're saying. We are in this together. We don't even hear that in churches anymore. You know,
I hate to say it, but we haven't really heard it from the president either. He hasn't been able to use his great rhetorical powers to really inspire people to understand that health care is a human right, and no one should be denied it, and it could happen to any of us, even if, you know, he's always saying, well, if you're happy with your health care, you can keep it. Well, if you're happy with your health care, you might lose it.
Right, exactly.
That's why we need a public system.
Yes. Absolutely. Well, we I don't want to waste your time, you know, talking about this because that could be a whole show in itself.
Yeah.
But I do want to make sure we talk about, you have a conference coming up. I think you told me it's called Gratitude.
Yes, this is going to be at in Montecito, California, at La Casa de Madre, which is a retreat center that was founded by the Immaculate Sisters of the Immaculate Heart, who who you may remember withdrew from the Catholic Church when the previous Pope thought that they were becoming a little too feminist and a little too radical. And it's a retreat for women, and I don't know if it's open to men or not. I haven't asked that question. There will be information about it on my website, which is www.goddessariadne.org. And the title of the conference is Gratitude, As We Have Been Given, So We Will Give. And we'll be creating rituals where we will be creating altars and offering first fruits and pouring libations. We'll be talking about the spirit of giving that we've just been talking about, that we have been given, so we share with others. And we'll be talking about honoring those who have given us life, honoring the feminine principle, the feminine divine, the goddess, and our Mother Earth. So I hope some of your listeners will look on the website, www.goddessariadne.org.
Would you
under
mind
lectures.
Saying- Would
and,
you mind saying
sign up.
The city and the dates again?
Yes, it's the first weekend in May 2010, and it's in Montecito, which is near Santa Barbara, California.
Okay, wonderful, Carol. If you send me an email blurb about that, I'll make some announcements, periodically throughout the month.
Well, that would be lovely.
On the radio show as well.
Yeah, and I'd love, of course, to have some of your listeners sign up for the Goddess Pilgrimage to Crete. We have tours in the spring and the fall in 2010 and again in 2011, and there's space still open on those tours for this year, too.
Well, I know whenever I've led tours or I've been on tours independently with just my husband or something, I've been so annoyed when you go to these sacred sites. And the reason I'm saying this is because it is so important if you have a like mind like we do, and I'm sure our listeners out there, you can't really necessarily take a mainstream tour and hear feminist theology or herstory. And a perfect example of that is in Delphi. They don't even talk much, if at all, about Delphi pre-Apollo. You know, they don't talk about Gaia necessarily and her giving the sight to her daughters. In Malta, you know, they call the beloved fat lady sumo wrestlers. You know?
Yes.
It's insane.
And in Crete, you'll hear about King Minos, who sat on the throne, and now it's thought by even many very straight non-feminist archaeologists that there was no King Minos sitting on a throne during the time of the Minoan culture, although it's been named for him. But yes, you hear these kinds of things, and in the museum and on the guidebooks, they feature, you know, the masculine images much more frequently than the feminine images.
Well, that reminds me of Egypt. You go to Egypt, all you hear about it are the pharaohs, you know, Ramses. You know, you don't, you know, hear so much about the goddesses. So the point I'm trying to make is, you know, listeners, if you are being called to make a sacred journey, please, if you expect to hear about herstory, about goddesses, about, you know, what you know, we all talk about, don't bother taking a mainstream tour because you just won't hear it.
Come with me or come with Karen on one of her sacred journeys.
Yes, yes. So, Carol, when are your tours? Do you know the months and the destinations?
Yes, we have two-week tours. One's at the end of May and early June, and the other's, I believe it's this year, it's completely the first 2 weeks of October.
You stick to the island of Crete.
We stay in Crete, and we have a wonderful combination of, you know, good food, and we have a night of Cretan dancing where everyone learns to do the sigano and really puts themselves back in a lot of ways to the ancient circle dance. And we have swimming and museums, and we go into caves and mountaintops, and we also form a community. We have small groups, less than 20 of women, and a lot of the women who come on the tour say that the most important thing for them is the community that forms of other pilgrims talking about their journeys and why they've come to Crete, why they're seeking the goddess how difficult it is to find in their lives at home and how thrilled they are to be with other women who share their dreams and visions. And we also have on my tour, because I've been doing it in Crete and I speak Greek, I've made lots of friends along the way and a lot of people who live traditional lifestyles talk to us about their lives. And it's amazing that people who are in their 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, their lives up to 20 years ago probably didn't differ tremendously from the lives of the ancient Minoans in terms of their everyday life, going out to the fields, growing, planting, harvesting, celebrating together with the community, the harvest and the planting times and so on. I mean, the big difference is that they did suffer quite dramatically in the Second World War and then in their own civil war afterwards, and have been occupied for centuries by various other cultures, including the Venetians. So that makes it different. But in terms of their day-to-day life, when there weren't wars, their lives were very similar, and it's so wonderful to talk to them and to meet people who, you know, by our terms, have very little. I mean, they're not living in dire poverty or anything like that anymore, but they have very little, and yet they say that they're happier. They were happier then than a lot of their children are now. And just gives you an understanding that life doesn't have to be so focused around materialism and machines.
So, Carol, I am curious, though. I mean, Greece is pretty heavily Christian. Do you ever find difficulty there? I mean, is there any kind of backlash? Have you had to be careful? Or?
Yeah, I mean, the Orthodox Church, it's actually not as oppressive, if you want to use that word, as the Catholic Church has been at various times in various cultures. It has a less of a role, really, in the society in terms of influencing laws and morals than the Catholic Church does, let's say, in Italy or in much of Latin America. I mean, even though the Church doesn't really approve of abortion, people have abortions quite freely here and don't feel guilty about it or anything like that. But yes, the church itself hasn't gone through very much modernization. And although I would say that the average, let's say, you know, farming, agricultural type of person has a lot of values that go back to the ancient religion, as, you know, the giving and receiving and the offering of the first fruits, even having the priest bless the seeds before they plant them in the fields. These things go back far before Christianity. Yet they tend to see any religion other than their own as negative. So they don't like yoga, they don't like, you know, the church doesn't like yoga, the church doesn't like Buddhism. And if they sort of suspect that somebody's really worshiping the ancient goddesses, some people don't like it. But you can't do rituals on archaeological sites, but we find ways around that.
Well, yeah. I would imagine you can do it in the caves, though, which is probably pretty incredible.
Yeah. Pretty powerful, yes.
So now let me just, one last question about Greece, and then we have still about 8 or 10 minutes. How is it for women in Greece? I know even here in the United States there's a backlash against, you know, feminism. How is it there? I mean, is there a feminist movement alive, or is that sort of suppressed, or how is it for women there?
Well, Greece is a very interesting case because it's officially a very patriarchal society. And up until the 1980s, marriage was traditionally defined if the man was the head of the household. Even in the case of divorce, the children stayed with the father, not the mother. And there certainly is, you know, a traditional male macho-ness in this society. There's violence in the home. So there's an official patriarchy, but underlying that, there's a great strength of women that has impressed me and continues to impress me, even in comparison to the United States in certain ways, because women who were out in the fields, you know, milking their lambs, making cheese, picking the olives and raising their children and cooking and cleaning and doing everything else. They knew they were strong. And there's a strength that I think probably is worldwide among women who are engaged in an agricultural lifestyle, that they know they're strong. And even though there's an official patriarchy, they have their ways around that. And in Greece, it's kind of humorous in a way. You always see when you go out, and especially in the villages, and it's true in my village too, the men are out sitting in the cafe nans playing cards or drinking coffee or later at night drinking ouzo or shipro or something, or raki, any liquor. And the women are kept at home traditionally. But another way of looking at it is that if the man was in the home, he'd be saying, bring me my socks, let me to watch whatever I want to watch on the television, bring me a coffee, bring me a blanket to put over my little feet. And the women just say, go out.
So they have time alone.
So you can look at it as, oh, isn't it wonderful they're free? But half the time you look at them, they don't look particularly happy sitting out there. So I'm not saying that it's a traditional matriarchy, but there's an underlying, there's always ways that women subvert cultures. And it's interesting that in Greece we don't have a feminist movement to speak of. Greece was under a dictatorship in the 60s and early 70s at the time the feminist movement arose. So it was not allowed to arise here because people couldn't create any of these movements during the dictatorship. So they basically didn't have a feminist movement, but the young women have moved into work roles. And problem is they really haven't gone through consciousness raising and critique of, you know, the fact that women still do all the work in the home, mm-hmm. even though they're working outside the home. And grandma's involved in looking after the children. And that system is not going to be able to work once the next generation comes about and women are working. They're not going to be able to look after their daughter's children. So
that's unfortunate.
Yeah.
Well, Carol, we're coming to the end here, and I want to make sure if there were if there was anything I haven't asked you that you wanted to make sure you mentioned, or any ideas you wanted to leave listeners with, maybe about the future of women's spirituality, or you know, whatever it is you feel important, now's the time.
I just wanted to say that I believe that I've been asked a lot of times when I speak about women's spirituality is, you know, is there a relation between spirituality and politics? And I think that, you know, there's not necessarily direct relationship, like you have to vote for Obama or you shouldn't vote for Obama because you believe in the goddess. But I think that women's spirituality is about affirming the body, affirming our relationship to the earth, and affirming our relationship to each other and community. So I think that that inevitably should issue out into work in the world and not just, you know, having it on special occasions or something like that. And I myself have recently been involved in the environmental movement here in Greece, and I think that's a natural place for women who love the Mother Earth to get involved, but of course it's not the only place. But I would encourage women to who are rediscovering their connection to Mother Earth to also get involved in politics. And I think your next week that you have Vandana Shiva coming on.
Jean Shinoda Bolan next week.
And you have Vandana Shiva coming on.
Oh, well, I'm going to talk about one of her interviews.
I was hoping you were getting her on. I've seen her on television. She's such a powerful speaker.
Well, I'm actually in the process of trying to get her and Eve Ensler. So we'll see if I can secure their interviews. Hopefully, I got my fingers crossed.
Well, actually, I've been so involved in it, I've been obsessed. I've been writing a complaint to the European Commission about non-enforcement of environmental laws in my island.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been, I think I've probably been working on this about 15 or 20 hours every day. I mean, and not every day, every week. Sometimes I work on it 15 or 20 hours in a day for over a year. And I've become so obsessed with it. I became a bird watcher, and then I started noticing that the areas where the birds were last year, this year they were landfilled or full of garbage or house or a hotel or gas station had been built there where there used to be a pool or a puddle. And, you know, I've just become so involved in it that it's almost as if my body has become part of the land. So right now they're building a road in the wetland area, big, you know, throughway, shall we say, highway, not, it's not a freeway. And I can't even drive through there because I just feel my body is being violated because my body has become one with this land and these birds that I love so much.
Well, that's sort of in keeping with the Aboriginal women who say, you know, if somebody sticks something in the earth, they feel it in their body. You know, they're that connected.
Well, that's what's happened to me, and it's actually quite painful. If anybody knows what the next step is, how you I guess you transform that the way I'm trying to, which is to try to work to transform the situation.
Well, but you know, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I have to say, it is the more sensitive you become to what's going on to our Mother Earth and all the plants and animals and people we share the world with, the more pain you feel.
Well, but, you know, I like to say when I'm out there giving talks or whenever I get the opportunity to teach women about the relevance of goddess spirituality that, you know, it's important to be the hands that rock the cradle, but we also have to be the hands that broker the deals that change the world. So,
yes.
You know, we can't do everything as just life giver. We do have to be in corporate America, in academia, in politics. Activists, we really just can't afford to, you know, take a back seat.
I agree. And I think even getting back to what we were talking about before, in the Neolithic, women weren't just mothers. It wasn't, the mother goddess wasn't just being a mother and nothing else. They were the creative centers of their culture. They were the planters, the harvesters, the weavers, the potters, the cookers, you know, but it wasn't just quote unquote in the home. We were out in the larger world, and we always have been, basically, except for brief periods of time when we've been told to stay strictly in the home.
Well, Carol, thank you so very much for taking your time to be with us. And it's night where you are, and it's lunchtime here. And thank you so much for being on the show once again. And I look forward to maybe seeing you, you know, here in the United States sometime down the road. And again, that conference is in Montecito in May. And listeners, please go to Carol's website, goddessariadne.com. And just in case.
.org.
.org. Thank you. Thank
mm-hmm.
you. I wrote down .com, so thank you for correcting me. And if you're not exactly sure how to spell Ariadne, Ariadne, goddessariadne.org, find out about Carol's, her lectures, this conference in Montecito, California, her tours in Greece. There's a wealth of information there on her website.
And my article, Why Women Need the Goddess, is on there too. But just to say goodbye, I'd like to share, actually it's a song, but I won't sing it, but a prayer that I think really expresses, since you're going to lunch.
Please do.
As we bless the source of life, so we are blessed. And to me, that really sums up the essence of what we've been talking about tonight.
Absolutely.
As we bless the source of life, so we are blessed. Mm. Blessed be.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much, Carol.
Thank you for having me on.
It's a pleasure, and I appreciate you taking the time.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Good night.
Good night.
So, listeners, if you're just tuning in, this is Karen Tate, hostess of Voices of the Sacred Feminine, where, as I tell you each week, I remind you we're discussing goddess, the divine feminine, the resurging interest in right brain thinking, or some like to call it the feminine consciousness, whether the great she be in your mind a deity, archetype, or ideal, and how those new values and benchmarks just might save the world. And our guest today was the delightful foremother, Carol Crist, who, as you can tell, works tirelessly for women and the divine feminine. I am going to take a very brief one-minute music break and return for our What's the Buzz segment. So please stay with me here. I will literally be back in about no more than 60 seconds. I'm going to leave you with a tune from Jenna Green called Dance With Me. And like I said, I'll be back in just a minute.
Pub, you'd had enough, such worry on your face I could tell. You got to drinking to stop you from thinking about your day of living hell. Well, the bass up to play and the fiddler is playing, the bar on time's out of bed. How I think it would do you some good to take my hand and move your feet. Stop counting your sorrows and dreading tomorrows, let your heart be wild.
Well, I'm back. I promised it would only be a minute, and here I am already. And we are turning to our What's the Buzz segment, when I discuss the bees buzzing around in my bonnet related to what's happening out there in the world, whether it be about spirituality, goddess advocates, or issues related to women or girls or ideas of the sacred feminine. And as I promised before, you know, it's a little tongue-in-cheek, but considering just the ugly divisiveness, you know, of Pat Robertson saying these poor, pitiful people in Haiti who are suffering so much are suffering because they made a pact with the devil, I want to share this letter that's circulating around the Internet. It comes from Kent B., from a super consciousness group, I think called Akira S. Anyway, it says, Satan writes a letter to Pat Robertson, and this is by Satan. He says, Dear Pat Robertson, I believe this was actually in the Star Tribune as well. Dear Pat Robertson, I know that you know that all press is good press, so I appreciate the shout-out. And you make God look like a big, mean bully who kicks people when they're down, so I'm all over that action. But when you say that Haiti has made a pact with me, it's totally humiliating. I may be evil incarnate, but I'm no welcher. The way you put it, making a deal with me leaves folks desperate and impoverished. Sure, in the afterlife, but when I strike bargains with people, they first get something here on earth. Glamour, beauty, talent, wealth, fame, glory, a golden fiddle maybe. Those Haitians have nothing, and I mean nothing. And that was before the earthquake. Haven't you seen Crossroads or Damn Yankees? If I had a thing going with Haiti, there'd be lots of banks, skyscrapers, SUVs, exclusive nightclubs, Botox, that kind of thing. An 80% poverty rate is not my style. Nothing against it. I'm just saying, not how I roll. You're doing great work, Pat, and I don't want to clip your wings. Just come on. You're making me look bad, and not the good kind of bad. Keep blaming God. That's working. But leave me out of it, please, or we may need to renegotiate your own contract. All the best, Satan. Anyway, I thought that was interesting and fun. But now on to more serious matters. I'm turning to Ms. Magazine to share information with you today, some of the bees buzzing around. And this is an article by Kavita Ramdas, and it's short but important, Why Women's Reproductive Freedom Ensures Our Survival. And Kavita Ramdas says, 15 years ago in Beijing, then First Lady Hillary Clinton said firmly, and I quote, women's rights or human rights, unquote. Today, after 8 years of non-existent U.S. support for women's reproductive rights, That means under the Bush administration. Secretary of State Clinton is reviving women's hopes around the globe by affirming the Obama administration's support for the International Conference on Population and Development Action Plan. This historic agreement, signed by 179 nations in Cairo in 1994, outlined a visionary 20-year strategy for making family planning universally available by 2015. For the first time, a global consensus acknowledged that the empowerment and economic independence of women and education of girls were integral to meeting global population and development goals. It was the first time that an international document clearly stated that women had the right to determine their own reproduction. And people here in the United States that'll listen to this too. Principle 4 of the action plan states, quote, ensuring women's ability to control their own fertility is a cornerstone of population and development-related programs, unquote. The founding president of the Global Fund for Women, Anne Firth Murray, noted that the Cairo Declaration was the first major UN document that defined women as independent sexual beings, not merely childbearers or mothers. In her words, quote, this was a revolution in women's empowerment, unquote. From villages in Bangladesh to urban favelas in Brazil, women use the language of Cairo to push for concrete gains in accessing reproductive health and rights. In many ways, worldwide, family planning has been a huge success. The global birth rate halved from 1950 to 2005. Many women around the world now view their right to freely and responsibly make decisions over their reproduction free from coercion and violence as a basic human right. Yet for some, the commitment to spreading freedom around the globe stops far short of ensuring women's reproductive freedom. At a recent House Foreign Affairs Committee hearing, Representative Christopher Smith, a Republican from New Jersey, aggressively questioned Hillary Clinton about whether the Obama administration's policies on reproductive health included access to abortion. Clinton responded unapologetically. She said, family planning is an important part of women's health, and reproductive health includes access to abortion that I believe should be safe, legal, and rare, unquote. We're going to need more straight talk of this nature, says the writer of the article, Kavita Ramdas, and we must walk our talk if we want to ensure that the groundbreaking gains of Cairo are not eroded by a growing conservative and religious backlash. And despite the dedicated work of the UN and women's rights advocates worldwide, more than 500,000 women still die annually from preventable childbirth-related injuries and illnesses. According to Population Action International, 1 in 65 women in developing countries risks dying during pregnancy or childbirth in her lifetime. Many of these are related to complications arising from unsafe abortions. In Mexico alone, up to 500,000 illegal abortions occur annually. Secretary Clinton's speech comes on the heels of a dismal global conversation on climate change that made it all too clear that we must find ways to effectively offset carbon emissions. Population growth and climate change will collide in ways that will put our lives at risk and will most grievously harm the poorest countries. In the Global Fund's own experience, when girls and women have greater access to education, not just the three R's of reading, writing, and arithmetic, but also the three C's, courage, contraception, and choice, their improved health leads to positive community outcomes, including economic growth and sustainable development. We agree with columnist Helen Goodman, who says, if we can lighten the burden on the planet while widening the chances for women, that's our kind of offset. And at least on the issues of women's reproductive rights, this is proving to be our kind of state government. You can go to MsMagazine.com and to the article by Kavita Ramdas, Why Women's Reproductive Freedom Ensures Our Survival. And the speech, there's a transcript there that that you can actually listen to or read. Okay, I think we have a caller. I am going to see what one of our listeners has to say. Hi, this is Karen. You're on the air. Who's this? Hello? Did you want to have a chat, or were you just listening?
There's a transcript there that that you can actually listen to.
Hello. Okay, I'm not. Maybe they're just listening, and they didn't actually want to. They didn't want to speak. Okay, that's all right. No problem at all. I hope you'll tune back in. I hope I didn't accidentally disconnect. Okay. All right, the other thing I wanted to share with you was The Feminist Response by Dr. Vandana Shiva, the world-renowned eco-feminist activist, who talks about how the U.S. is totally captive in the hands of big business, which led to failure at the Copenhagen Climate Change Conference. And, you know, listeners, we're seeing that over and over again. That's why, you know, we didn't even seriously consider a single-payer health care in this supposed health care reform, because our politicians are so much, in the hands of corporate America. You know, things are just not geared toward what's good for individual Americans. It's geared toward what's good for the corporation. And unfortunately, a corporation doesn't always have their workers' or America's interests at heart. You know, it's always their shareholders in their bottom line. Anyway, the United Nations Climate Change Conference in Copenhagen not that long ago, it turned out to be a fractious two-week meeting of 193 countries trying to create a legally binding international treaty to curb climate change. And they say it sort of ended with a whimper and not much hope. What emerged was the Copenhagen Accord, which was just a non-binding treaty, which, while making reference to the need to cut emissions, had no long-term reduction targets. Also in Copenhagen, but not an official participant in the conference, was Dr. Vandana Shiva. As I said, she's a renowned ecofeminist activist, and she heads the organization Navdanya, Navdanya, which I'm sure you can Google. And Navdanya seeks to create a new paradigm for a sustainable model of agriculture and development that puts women's empowerment at the center. Speaking passionately to tens of thousands of climate activists at the Alternative People Summit held outside the official conference, she stressed the urgent need for a legally binding treaty. And she was asked a few questions by Holly Tomlinson of Ms. Magazine. And Ms. asks Dr. Shiva, "What's your reaction to the outcome of the Copenhagen talks?" And then Donna Shiva says, "When you have a problem as serious as climate change, I don't call it climate change. Let me start over again. I read that wrong. What's your reaction to the outcome of the Copenhagen talks?" And her answer, "When you have a problem as serious as climate chaos, I don't call it climate change. What you need is a deepening of commitments to reduce emissions. You need very concrete measures. What you don't need is just political declarations with no legally binding content. What we have from Copenhagen is a non-legally binding treaty signed by a handful of countries, the majority of countries who are victims of climate change and were driving this process are not going to sign. They're very disappointed as the citizens of the world." Ms. Magazine says, "Do you feel that this was a likely or even inevitable result given the way the talks were proceeding?" And Shiva says, "No, it wasn't an inevitable result. When the heads of states came at the end of the conference, there was a text. It wasn't a perfect text, but it was about legally binding emission targets, and it respected the urgency of the issue. But that was put aside, and that's when things started to fall apart. And then finally, President Obama and China and India, the big three countries, basically got together and hustled together a text." Ms. asks her, "Well, what do you think caused that turnaround?" Shiva says, "Well, when it comes to key matters that affect the environment and ordinary people, the United States is totally captive in the hands of big business. And it's the big business that causes the pollution, the automobile industry, the oil industry, the agrochemical industry. Short-term profits drive at the cost short-term profit drive at the cost of the planet's future. That's the only way corporations think. Democracy was supposed to be by the people, of the people, for the people. It's been reduced to by the corporations, of the corporations, for the corporations. So when this mutation takes place and states become corporate states, then the outcome of Copenhagen becomes an inevitability. This is difficult to recognize because the apparent contest is between rich countries and poor countries. But while poor countries have no corporations or very few, they have all the damage of climate change, such as floods and drought. So behind the rich countries are big corporations, and the poor countries are, in fact, representing people and nature. Ms. Magazine says, do you believe that the outcome of Copenhagen would have been different if women's voices were better heard within the negotiations and if gender-specific issues of climate change, such as the disproportionate effect that it has on women, had been better addressed? Shiva says, definitely. Women are losing their water. Today, women in the Indian region of the Himalayas have to wait for 8 hours for a tiny pot of water from a dying stream. So we are talking of women's burdens being very, very high. If that burden was being heard in those corridors of power, there would have been a very different outcome. Because then, women's voices would have joined with the voices of the countries like the Maldives and the G77, a coalition of developing countries. And we'd have had one wonderful chorus to say, the planet is in crisis, and the planetary crisis is creating a burden for women. Stop the burden. Ms. says, what would be your message to Ms. readers about what we should be advocating with regard to climate change? Shiva says, do not let your president get away with an empty promise of 3% emission reductions. Push your government to be part of an international community with a legally binding instrument brought back on track by the time we get to Mexico for the 2010 climate negotiations. And finally, you yourselves can be a solution. We have to make sure that the international treaty process carries on. But at home, join the organic movement. If Michelle Obama can have an organic form, why can't the rest of the world? So if you want to read that for yourself, again, that's MsMagazine.com, fall 2009. It's the Copenhagen article on a feminist response. And let's see, the next thing I wanted to share with you is an interesting article I came across that was food for thought. Are Americans too broken for the truth to set us free? It asks if we've become too passive of as a people, if our morale can be restored. And the reason this was interesting to me is because I've been wondering, you know, why we've been so passive and complacent. And I'm going to take a minute here to actually change phones because I think my battery is having a problem. So I think I'll probably be good now for the rest of the show. Anyway, this is an article that comes from the mostlywater.org blog, and the title is what I said, Are Americans Too Broken for the Truth to Set Us Free? It's written by Bruce Levine, and he says, can people become so broken that truths of how they are being screwed do not set them free, but instead further demoralizes them? Has such a demoralization happened in the United States? Do some totalitarians actually want us to hear how we have been screwed? Because they know that humiliating passivity in the face of obvious oppression will demoralize us even further. What forces have created a demoralized, passive, discouraged U.S. population? Can anything be done to turn this around? Yes, it's called abuse syndrome. How do abusive pimps, spouses, bosses, corporations, and governments stay in control? They shove lies, emotional and physical abuses, and injustices in their victims' faces, and when victims are afraid to exit from these relationships, they get weaker. And so the abuser then makes their victims eat even more lies, abuses, injustices, resulting in victims even weaker as they remain in these relationships. Can't help but connect the dots to Fox News and all the commentators there with their lies and abuse and injustice. So does the truth of their abuse set people free when their deep in this abuse syndrome. No, for victims of the abuse syndrome, the truth of their passive submission to humiliating oppression is more than embarrassing. It can feel shameful, and there's nothing more painful than shame. And when one already feels beaten down and demoralized, the likely response to the pain of shame is not constructive action, but more attempts to shut down or divert oneself from this pain. It's not likely that the truth of one's humiliating oppression is going to energize one's constructive actions. So they ask, has such a demoralization happened in the U.S.? In the United States, 47 million people are without health insurance, and many millions more are underinsured or a job layoff away from losing their coverage. But despite the current sellout by their elected officials to the insurance industry, there is no outpouring of millions of U.S. citizens on the streets of Washington, D.C., protesting this betrayal. You see, that's what I've been thinking. Where are people protesting everything that's going on here? Polls show that the majority of Americans oppose U.S. wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, as well as the taxpayer bailout of the financial industry, yet only a handful of citizens have protested any of this. Remember the 2000 U.S. presidential election? That's the one in which Al Gore received 500,000 more votes than George Bush. 500,000 more votes than George Bush. That's also the one that the Florida Supreme Court's order for a recount of the disputed Florida vote was overruled by U.S. Supreme Court in a politicized 5-4 decision, of which the dissenting justice John Paul Stevens remarked, quote, although we may never know with the complete certainty the identity of the winner of this year's presidential election, the identity of the loser is perfectly clear. It is the nation's confidence in the judge as an impartial guardian of the rule of law, unquote. Yet even all this provoked few demonstrations. When people become broken, they cannot act on truths of injustice. Furthermore, when people have become broken, more truths about how they have been victimized can lead to shame about how they have allowed it. And shame, like fear, is one more psychological way we become even more broken. U.S. citizens do not actively protest obvious injustices for the same reasons that people cannot leave their abusive spouse. They feel helpless to affect change. The more we don't act, the weaker we get, and ultimately to deal with the painful humiliation over inaction in the face of an oppressor, we move to shut down and escape strategies such as depression, substance abuse, and other diversions which keep us from acting. Maybe even uber consumerism. Let's just go buy something. That'll make this all go away. This is the vicious cycle of all abuse syndromes. So do totalitarians actually want us to hear how and why we've been screwed, because they know that humiliating passivity in the face of oppression will demoralize us even further? Well, maybe. Shortly before the 2000 U.S. presidential election, millions of Americans saw a clip of George Bush joking to a wealthy group of people saying, "What a crowd tonight, the haves and the have-mores. Some people call you the elite, I call you my base," unquote. That's what W said. Yet even with these kinds of inflammatory remarks, the tens of millions of U.S. citizens who had come to despise Bush and his arrogance remained passive in the face of the 2000 non-democratic presidential elections. Perhaps the political genius of the Bush-Cheney regime was fully realizing that Americans were so broken that they could get away with damn near anything. And the more people did nothing about the boot slamming on their faces, the weaker people became. So what forces have created a demoralized, passive, discouraged U.S. population? The U.S. government corporate partnership has used its share of guns and terror to break Native Americans, labor union organizers, and other dissidents and activists. But today, most U.S. citizens are broken by financial fears. There is potential legal debt if we speak out against a powerful authority, and all kinds of other debt if we do not comply on the job. Young people are broken by college loan debt and fear of having no health insurance. The U.S. population is increasingly broken by the social isolation created by corporate government policies. the 2006 American Sociological Review study called Social Isolation in America reported that 25% of Americans did not have a single confidant in 2004. Sociologist Robert Putnam in Bowling Alone describes how social connectedness is disappearing in virtually every aspect of U.S. life. For example, there has been a significant decrease in face-to-face contact with neighbors and friends due to suburbanization, commuting, electronic entertainment, time and money pressures, and other variables created by governmental corporate policies and union activities and other formal or informal ways that people give each other the support necessary to resist oppression have also decreased. We're also broken by a corporate government partnership that has rendered most of us out of control when it comes to the basic necessities of life, including our food supply. And we, like many other people in the world, are broken by socializing institutions that alienate us from our basic humanity. Well, there's more to this article, and I'm going to stop there. I'm going to call it part one and part two. I'm going to pick up the conclusion of this next week. But if you want to go there before I do, because I certainly think it's reflecting what's going on out there in America and, you know, why we just are not speaking out and, you know, why we're not letting our government see us and hear us. Anyway, go to mostlywater.org, mostlywater.org. And, again, the article is, Are Americans Too Broken for the Truth to Set Us Free? And that's by Bruce Levine. Okay, let's see where we are with tonight's show. I posed the question earlier that I was going to ask, are you concerned about the anti-intellectualism movement or the dumbing down of America? If you have comments about that, I'd love to hear from you. If you want to call in or if you'd like to email me, I'm happy to read your comments over the air. I'd love to hear from you because it's a constant bee in my bonnet these days. It really disturbs me to turn on the news and hear lies being spoken as if they're truth. It really disturbs me to hear commentators filling the airways with lies and people, I assume, just believing what they're being fed, and they don't even realize what's going on. I think it's dangerous. I think it's very dangerous, and it bothers me that real journalists, when they interview people on television and these people just lie, that the journalists don't challenge them. I think this is a real concern because we would turn to the news media outlets, to journalists for integrity, for truth, for a balanced view of what's going on. And, you know, so many millions of people are just, you know, hearing distortions and mischaracterizations. You know, death panels. Our president isn't a U.S. citizen. I mean, all the absurdities. You know, when people believe absurdities, I think it was Voltaire said, when people believe absurdities, they're more willing to commit atrocities. I think this is scary. So if any listeners out there agree or have any comments about this dumbing down of America, this anti-intellectualism movement, the seeming pride and, you know, not being smart, you know, let me hear from you. I'd like to hear what you have to say. And as I always say each week, because our words are powerful and it's important to put things out there into the ethers, the reason I consistently have this segment in each show is because it is important to shed the light of day on injustice and oppression. We can't count on people to do the right thing just because it's the right thing to do. Sometimes people are motivated by money, power, greed, and, you know, they don't care about the exploitation or the oppression. You know, it's good for them, and that's all they care about, which harkens back to the conversation with Carol earlier in the show. You know, where is that attitude that we are in this together? Let's make sure all of our boats float. We just are not told that by our religious leaders, by our political leaders, by not many people. And that really needs to be the message, not individualization and, you know, survival of the fittest. I mean, that's just insane. So sometimes we need incentive, shall we say. We have to keep the pressure on because the divisiveness and the programming has been pervasive. Look how quickly women's abortion rights got sacrificed in the healthcare negotiations. The fearmongers and the intolerant can be deafening and often seem to always be ratcheting up their dogma. We have to constantly educate, whether we're educating about women's issues or water rights or human issues. You know, we really need to know what's going on out there in the world, whether it's across town or across the globe. There's so much disinformation and intentional deflection going on. We have to inoculate ourselves against ignorance, against intolerance, and all those isms. And I encourage you to do the same. Share this information with your loved ones. Sign online petitions in solidarity of causes that perpetuate ideals of the divine feminine or those that uplift women. Volunteer where you can. Teach. Support those of like mind, because we women are more than the hands that rock the cradles. We must be the hands that broker the deals that change the world. So with that being said, the bees are released from my bonnet for this week. And getting on to a couple of announcements. The Four Mothers and Wayshower series, we're still in the middle of that. It's still running. Next week we finish out January. Can you believe the first month of the year is already gone? With the noted foremother, Jean Shinoda Bolen. In February, we have the powerful feminist advocate and author, Phyllis Chesler, on the show, who wrote the book Women's Inhumanity to Women, which I think is so very important because our patriarchal culture pits women against one another, causing competition and insidiously bad behavior among women rather than having us support one another. Also, Ava Park, the center holder and foundress of the Goddess Temple of Orange County, will be one of our guests in February. Dr. David Hillman, author of The Chemical Muse, is going to be on the show. You're going to love David. We'll be talking more about authentic herstory of ancient priestesses in Greece. Because we really don't usually understand from academia what they're about, because what we've been taught has been so clouded by the Christian lens. And we talked a little bit about that tonight, just briefly with Carol. And for a change of pace and some fun, David's going to be coming back on the show, and we're going to dissect that movie that's coming out, Percy Jackson and the Olympians. We're going to play Good Cop and Bad Cop, about how that movie plays itself out and what's real and not real, and what ideas they put forth that are accurate and which ones are distorted. And finally, Christina Biaggi is also going to be a guest in February. So you listeners, you asked, where are the Four Mothers and Wayshowers? And they are here every week, usually on Wednesday night at 6 p.m. Pacific, and that is our regular show time. We're going to go back to that next week. Today's show was just an exception because Carol Christ is in Greece and the time change difference. But our Four Mothers and Wayshowers are still out there generously giving more of their time for you to hear what is stoking their passions these days. Now, remember, here on Blog Talk, you can take I can take your caller questions, and I hope you will call in. So if you like, dial in and ask questions toward the end of the interview for my guest or after my What's the Buzz segment. The number is 718-766-4662, and talk to me. When I see your call on the switchboard, I'll identify you by your area code and welcome you to have a chance to ask our guest a question. And if you can't listen live or don't want to be on the air, that's okay, too. You can always email me some of your questions in advance. And please, if you're a fan of the show, if you like what you're hearing, please indicate that by selecting us as a favorite or a friend on Blog Talk Radio. Let's see, what else do I want to share with you this week? Do you know that I have 2 years of archived radio shows on my website, KarenTate.com, from when I was on Passionate Internet Voices Radio? Yep, they're right there and downloadable and free. I've had wonderful guests like Jean Houston, Margaret Starbird, Selena Fox, Rianne Eisler, Matthew Fox, so many wonderful leaders and movers and shakers who are working diligently for goddess ideals and to make the world a better place. So go there when you can. I think you'll enjoy what's there. I hope you'll check out my articles on examiner.com. It's kind of like my blog. I'm only one of a very few goddess advocates in the United States writing for the Examiner. You can find them by going to examiner.com and putting my name in the search box. Articles by me or about me will pop up, or you can find a link to my articles on the homepage of my website, KarenTate.com. My mentors have inspired me to do my small part out there in the world, to be visible, to teach, to activate minds and hearts about ideals of the sacred feminine that address cultural issues, women's issues, and the politics of spirituality, from healthcare to sexism and the inhumanity of political platforms that put profits before people and don't care that everybody's boat is floating. This Saturday is the second of 11 classes I'm teaching at the Goddess Temple of Orange County. The curriculum is a feminist theology curriculum called Cakes for the Queen of Heaven. You might think of it as Goddess 101. If you're interested in that, please email me at KarenTate108@ca.rr.com. Last week, we covered the sacred female, honoring our ancestors, individual attitudes toward the female body and female sexuality, and veneration of the female in ancient times. This class is going to be in the name of the mother and daughter. Using the ancient Demeter Persephone myth, we're going to view mother-daughter relationships under patriarchy in goddess lore. We're going to compare ancient view of the celebration of women's life stages with contemporary society's views. Next session is Women Power, followed by the shift from goddess to god. After that is Reclaiming Women's Heritage and Power. Then we're going to get on to the second part of the curriculum, and the sessions are the Hebrew Goddess, Sarah the Priestess, Mary Magdalene, the Virgin Mary, Witchcraft, and Intentions. Intentions, the final one, is a new world view that has emerged in decades. In recent decades, our hopes for ourselves and for institutions and our societies, and as you know, it really gets back to what I said, how women are being called upon to rethink and restore and reclaim who they really are in the world, reclaim their power so that we become the hands that broker the deals that change the world. If you're in the Malibu area, I'm actually going to be giving a talk this Sunday on the esoterica and mysticism of sacred travel and sacred sites of goddess around the world. It's going to be from 3 to 5 o'clock at Olandor, which we refer to as the Sophia Temple. It's the home of Carla and Lee's beautiful, Carla and Lee McCloskey and their beautiful home in Malibu. Again, please email me if you need details. In May, I've been invited to travel to San Francisco. I'm going to be giving a presentation in the Bay Area for Her Church, that feminist Methodist group. So let's connect there if you're a listener in the Bay Area. I invite you to go visit my media page of my website, catch the radio interviews I'm invited to do, or go to my YouTube channel where I have some wonderful videos of the Isis Temple of Thanksgiving, Sekhmet's Mountain Sanctuary, and snippets of a lecture I gave on the sacred feminine for a sustainable future. I'd also like you to know I have two books out. Besides being a radio show host, I lead sacred tours, and I've written two books, and I'm a national speaker and lecturer. My books are there on my website, or you can actually get them at Amazon or your local bookstore. But I actually offer a pretty good deal, better than Amazon. You can get both my books for $25 plus shipping and handling. The first one I wrote was Sacred Places of Goddess, 108 Destinations, which I'm proud to say has garnered prestigious endorsements. It was sort of the culmination of having traveled across 5 continents, chasing down sacred sites of goddess. And then the second book, Walking in Ancient Paths, it won a place as a finalist in the USA National Best Books of 2008 Awards. And it's a lot of people have said wonderful things. In fact, the book is being used as a teaching curriculum. And scholar David Hillman, I like his remarks, actually. He says, Walking an Ancient Path is an immensely pleasurable and enlightening journey that stands boldly against the patriarchal denigration of the divine feminine. And that's really what my work is about. The book is divided into four sections. The Earth section talks about the experiences on sacred journeys. The Water section is about ritual and our emotions and how we connect with Goddess through ritual. The Fire section is about our empowerment and transformation. The Egyptian goddess Sekhmet, how she's an archetype for women today to reclaim their power. It's about politics of spirituality, too, because, you know, the politics exist within the goddess spirituality movement. It isn't always pretty. And the Air section is about how we hear her whispers, how she inspires us, and how we vision the future. So I invite you to take a look at Walking an Ancient Path. I am available to appear in a town near you if someone wants to invite me, as the folks in San Francisco have. I just need your group to sponsor me. You can check out the talks I have available for your group on my website. You can also check out articles I've published, and there are links there to other important people around the world making a difference, because there are lots of people out there in every nook and cranny who are trying to shift this paradigm toward restoring goddess ideals at the center of our world. So I would like to leave you today with a prayer. I invite you to close your eyes and take a deep breath with me, and you know, bring an even deeper focus and hear these lovely words and sort of drink them in, and perhaps help your day be an even better day. Great Mother of all, thank you for the blessings of bread, of love, of home, of family, of friends, of abundance, of harvest. As I reflect on all my blessings, I know that more is flowing to me like a river. I am grateful, and in my heart of hearts, as I easily receive and fully enjoy all good things from you, Mother Earth, I gracefully send the energy of all back out into the world of women and men who are ready and willing also to receive. Blessed be. Blessed be. So again, gratitude for what we have, because we do have so much. Just turn on the TV and look at these people in Haiti. We have, even in our dire straits here in the United States with so many suffering, we have so much to be grateful for. And again, the subject, the topic of reciprocity, I gracefully send the energy of all back out into the world of women and men ready and willing to receive. It's a cycle. It's a cycle of reciprocity. Nature teaches us that. We water a plant. The plant grows and gives us food. We give and we receive. That is the nature of things. It isn't all about us and everything we can get for ourselves. That's not a healthy way to think about things and look where it's gotten our world. So thank you, listeners, for tuning in once again. Remember, next week, Jean Shinoda Bolin will be our guest. And I'm going to close out the show, as I usually do, with some music from one of the generous artists who offer their music. And because the subject has been Carol Christ and Greece, I'm going to leave you with Lane Redman's music, and it's called The Final Delphic Oracle. Here it goes. See you next week. Enjoy, and have a great day. Carpe diem.
Above all things, speak the truth. Do nothing to excess.
accept the gifts the gods have given you. Choose not the advice of others. Make your own nature your guide in life. The king. The well-crafted temple has fallen to pieces. Apollo dwells here no more. There is no more oracular laurel. No talking spring. And the voice of the water has been silenced. All is finished. seeing speak the truth. Know thyself. Know thyself.